Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. We've heard of medical tourism, where people go on vacation to other countries to get more affordable medical procedures. Now this trend is being turned inside out. There's new cosmetic surgery procedure on the horizon. Vacation breasts. This idea is that women can get temporary breast enhancement for their beach vacations. I didn't make this up.
Why not?
Is it ever wise to get any kind of temporary medical cosmetic enhancement? Joining us on the line for his take on this and other medical ethical issues, thankfully, is Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also co-host of a terrific Everyday Ethics podcast. Hey there, Art.
How are you?
Good morning, Art. You know, as much as I'd love to start with vacation breasts, we have a very sad and tragic development this morning. As well you know, Dr. Martin Salia, who went to Sierra Leone to treat victims with Ebola, has died, second person to die of the disease in the United States, 44 years old, a husband, two kids from Maryland. Here's the question. Should we be newly panicked again, or is the fact that this physician was so sick when he got home before he even got to the hospital the big factor here? What's the takeaway?
Well, he was very, very ill. I'm surprised they were even able to bring him here from what I've heard. He was in the end stages of Ebola, meaning he couldn't keep any fluids in his body, and I'm not surprised, sadly, that he died. He was a dual citizen. He had spent time fighting Ebola, so he really did die a hero's death in terms of trying to help others. I don't think there's any reason for panic whatsoever. I think he went straight into the high containment facility special unit that's out there in Nebraska. There's one like it at Emory. The only people who have anything to worry about are his caregivers, and the people in that unit are super well trained. No reason for panic. One thing to realize is we're going to get a few more of these folks. I think there are other Americans over there trying to stamp out the epidemic. Somebody is likely to get infected still. So I would expect one or two more cases, although hopefully not as sick as this doctor was.
Well, that's the one thing I did worry about. There seemed to have been some delay between their realizing he had Ebola and their getting him back to the United States for treatment. That's what I wondered about. It seems like, to me, the moment you find out someone has it, they're on the airplane.
Yeah, and that's the best stance to take, because here we've got much better fluid provision, chemistry measurements of your bodies, what's called electrolytes, just the chemicals in your blood that you need to keep in balance. We can handle infections. Can't cure Ebola, but we can kind of get you through it, as nearly everybody who's made it here has made it through. I think, however, in his case, he was off in a rural place. He started to get symptoms. They couldn't get him from where he was to the airport in time. So I think there were a lot of, if you will, tactical problems that he faced in trying to get here.
Now, Marjorie, let me ask you before I pose the next issue to Art. Can you wait on vacation breasts just for a few more minutes?
I can wait. I want to get the details. I'm going on vacation soon, so I just want to know what my
mood should be. As they say, TMI. Okay. Art, there's, I think, a very provocative piece in the New York Times on Friday, deciding whether to disclose mental disorders to the boss. On one hand, they're roughly, they say in this piece, you know this, obviously, that roughly 18% of American adults suffer from some form of mental, behavioral, emotional disorder. Mm-hmm. The writer also mentions that the Americans with Disabilities Act protects somebody who makes such a disclosure as long as they can perform the core functions of their work. But I have to say, the stigma, at least in my anecdotal experience, is still so serious. My answer to when you should disclose to the boss is never, if possible. What's your answer?
Boy, I hate to agree with you, but I think that's true. I think the stigma around mental illness is enormous. A lot of these mass shootings we've seen recently have linked up mental illness to violence, even though statistically it still is true that far more people are hurt because they're mentally ill than do harm to anybody else. But the stigma is just huge. It gets over to a kind of, suck it up, hang in there better. You can overcome this. Nobody would say it about cancer. Nobody would ever say it about a broken bone. But a mind that's damaged or has issues, you know, we tend to be kind of intolerant. I don't know that I'd talk to the boss about this unless I had some reason, you know, I was applying for disability or I needed some extra time off or something. But generally, No, I can't say I would do it either.
You know, I naively assumed, I mean, there was great work done by Tipper Gore, Al Gore's former wife, and a variety of other people along the way. I naively assumed that the tipping point, for lack of a better expression, when things were going to finally turn around, is when people who everybody says they respect, members of the military, come home with PTSD, and we realize that, as we've heard so many people say, you can see a broken arm, but you can't see what happens to someone's head when they have to live through things like that. I assumed that was going to begin to change things, but I have to say, I don't see a dramatic change at all in the public perception of mental illness being no different than a visible physical illness or ailment or something like that. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think you are, and that's the reason I went to the mass gun violence, the high school, the shopping center. There, they've become the paradigm of mental illness, and clearly the people involved in these things often did have mental illness. But kind of like Ebola, these 10, 12, 20 incidents, they become what mental illness is all about, a madman with a gun blindly murdering everybody in sight. It isn't the person who can't sleep or is afraid to come out of the house or has some sort of depression that paralyzes them. That's not the image people have. I think, again, we're kind of the victims of the media here. We see the big violent case, and that becomes the poster child for what mental illness is.
So how does it change? I assume you go to meetings with fellow ethicists and others and say, we have to change this. And obviously insurance programs are changing. What's the thing that does it?
You know, it's really interesting. Even my field, bioethics, where you think people would be ethically concerned about the vulnerable, they haven't paid as much attention to mental illness. We like the high-tech stuff. We get all worked up about, you know, somebody doing a stem cell transplant to allow someone to walk. And that's great, but that's also probably 10 years down the road and would affect, you know, maybe 20,000 people. Mental illness affects tens of millions of people. And yet bioethics, too, doesn't pay attention. It's not sexy. It doesn't have high technology. It's controversial. And to tell you the truth, Jim and Marjorie, the mentally ill often have competency issues. And that's really tough to deal with. You know, you're sort of trying to decide, can this person really make the decision for themselves? I think the bioethics crowd, my crowd, likes cleaner cases. You know, you're competent, but you're choosing to end your own life. Well, I'm not sure we ought to give you that right. It's a little easier to go there.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The editor of The Atlantic wrote that book about his severe anxiety problems. But I suppose in that case, and it was called My Age of Anxiety. Scott Stossel was the writer.
And he kept it to himself for decades,
he did
right?
keep it to himself. But I suppose you could say, well, if you're editor of The Atlantic and you're kind of anxious and you're kind of a little neurotic in your office, who cares? Maybe it helps you write your stuff faster. But if you were something else, like a lawyer, maybe, or someone that was a physician or someone that was called on to make life and death and judgment decisions, you can see where people, if they knew, you would be treated differently. You'd be second-guessed all the time.
Yeah, I think that is a problem, and it gets back to that competency theme. So no one who's an air traffic controller or somebody who's going to be holding other people's lives in their hands wants to admit to stress or depression or anxiety. Those just, even our friends coming back, our heroes from the military, you know, mental illness is still carrying that stigma of cowardice. It's a moral judgment. It isn't just, you know, damage. It's somehow you weren't tough enough or
you
weren't brave enough or something. So I'm not getting the ethicists off the hook here. I actually just did put out a little book on ethics and mental health care because I felt so strongly that we weren't paying attention to it. But just like the celebrity crowd, we could use a lot more walkathons for different types of mental illness and more celebrities coming forward. Some have, but we need more prominent people to say, I've got this. This is a problem. I don't know if you need to tell the boss, but it would be nice to tell the rest of us.
What's the name? What's the name of your booklet?
It's called Ethics and Mental Health.
Terrific. Ethics and Mental Health by Art Kaplan. That's whose voice you're hearing right now.
MIT Press, published right in the
name. Oh, terrific. Let's move on, Art, to something else, which I found fascinating. The whole idea of whose responsibility it is when a patient doesn't show up. If you go into your doctor says you have, this example in the New York Times, you get high blood pressure, the doctor scheduled an MRI, MRI, rather, within a few weeks. But the person, unlike Jim, who has had many MRIs, as we know, she never followed up. So who's responsible?
Doesn't he have a machine in his house?
No, I have an MRI technician on retainer is what Marjorie meant. But go ahead, Art.
He actually does. I've met him.
No, I do not.
I would like
to have one.
We've been at his office.
So whose responsibility is this? Apparently, anywhere from, what does it say in this piece, 10 to 50% of people miss follow-ups. Is it the doctor's responsibility to stay on top of this or the patient's?
No. It's the patient's responsibility. Doctors just are nag. It's a little like saying, what's your mother's responsibility if you won't get out of bed to go to school on time? I don't think it's your mother's. I think it's you. Your mother can nag you and yell at you and, you know, set alarms and stuff. But ultimately, patients got to take charge. Now, I know there are patients out there and the rest of us, too, thinking, well, my doctor keeps me waiting. So, what, you know, isn't this a two-way street? What if I show up and he or she is an hour late? Well, I think we all understand people get behind on the job. Some patients take more time. Emergencies happen. I'm not excusing it. I think it should be explained better than it often is in the office. But when the patient just doesn't show, that's on the patient. And I'll tell you what, I would make them pay something.
Well, you know, one of the things I've noticed in my doctor's practice is I do get notices from her saying it's time to go get a mammogram. It's time to get to come back
too.
For
I
a
get
physical.
Calls, yeah.
So
you
I
get
guess...
mammogram notes, Jim?
You get some
hard. I might not.
Full ride.
Yeah. So is that unusual?
No. Most practices are moving to reminders because patients are so badly behaved.
Yeah.
So they're trying to send you emails. They're trying to send you postcards. They're trying to remind you. There's a little bit of a fiscal interest, obviously. If you come in for visits, they're going to make some money. But really, it's good health practice. You know, they want you to follow up. The biggest problem, I think, in the use of medicines is noncompliance. That is, you take your blood pressure med for a month and they say, hey, I feel pretty good. I'm not going to take this anymore. Or, you know, you decide to dose yourself. I'll take three of these. That way, if I missed one, I'll make it up. So those issues, not coming in on time, trying to get behavior management of patients is a big, big challenge in healthcare.
Let me just say one quick thing about was the point that you were suggesting before that if you schedule a follow-up and don't do it, you should have to pay something for it? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
I am totally with you. I have to say I have occasionally canceled follow-ups out of fear, frankly. I'm serious.
Yeah.
With a dentist or nervousness about a test result.
And also because they made you wait too long in the office.
Well, maybe, but I'll tell you, if I knew I had to pay $20 or whatever the copay or something was, I would probably not do that. So I am totally with you on that, Art Kaplan.
We're talking to Art Kaplan from NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's our medical ethicist.
Here she goes.
So here's the story we've all been waiting for.
Not we all, Marjorie.
Well, some of us anyway. The temporary vacation breasts may be here by 2016. Now, let me read the top of this little piece. That this particular physician has been offering women the ability to test drive breast implants with these lunchtime lifts and instant breast enlargement that lasts 24 hours. The same guy is now hard at work on vacation breasts that allow the new augmentation to last 2 to 3 weeks.
This was on ABC, by the way, so this is
this
not
isn't
some...
made up. This,
yeah,
is
exactly.
This is a real physician, a New York City doctor. So, Art, is there an ethical issue with vacation breasts or even the lunchtime lift?
Yes, there is. It's deception. What? All those guys out there leering at you and then you deflate? How can that be honest? How can that be honest? So it seems to me the risk-benefit here better be looked at pretty carefully. You know, it can't be good to temporarily throw saline or something into you and then have it go away. I know you asked me, well, do we ever do other things like this? I believe that is called the cosmetics industry, where we dye our hair or put lipstick on or do other things temporary and then remove them or they fade away. But changing your body form, I don't know. It seems to me, unless it's absolutely risk-free, just too dangerous to get into. And then I'll have to ask you, Margie, don't you need two wardrobes for this?
I guess so. I mean, the whole thing seems weird to me. On the other hand, having interviewed women who had significant issues, you know, and you know this, sometimes women have one breast that's significantly bigger than the other breast.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think people like you, Jim, would deride this all as people being vain and concerned
about
their body.
Well, I'm not a huge believer in cosmetic surgery unless you have a serious problem.
Well, the serious problem is in the eye of the beholder. And I think a lot of women have serious issues because of breast issues. So it's not like they're just these, you know, but, trying to be.
Yeah, but the issue is not the issue you're raising, I think, Art, is not whether or not there should be cosmetic surgery. The issue is whether these temporary things are proven to be as risk-free as possible. Isn't that where you're going, or are?
Yeah. I'm not against cosmetic surgery. I think people can be free to, you know, make themselves look better if they want to get rid of their wrinkles and so forth. But what I worry about is the risk. Some of these things just, you know, have been shown, like breast implants, a number of them over the years,
right,
to be nasty. And I worry about one other thing. Look, culturally, we're into breasts. If you go to some other countries, they're into butts, although I guess
we're
Kim Kardashian photobomb makes
that is another culture, believe me.
I think. Yeah, well, that's true. So, you know, partly it's getting calm about your body type. I mean, I want to say to women, look, if you're really out there and you think you're only going to attract men on the at poolside just because you have inflated breasts, do you really, really want that guy anyway? I don't know. I mean, part of me just gets a little angry when you're doing things for what the culture says is a desirable look as opposed to what you're comfortable with. If you're not comfortable and you want to change it, I'm okay with that. But, you know, don't just do it because, you know, it's what's in magazines or something.
Renee Zellweger is hoping that that head is temporary, too, that new head of
God.
Hers.
Oh.
But put
that
let's
awful.
Not even get it. Hey,
awful.
Just for a second, send your angry email to Art Kaplan, not to us. Art, you just said, you know, if women want to do it for men, a lot of women do this for themselves, right? They want to look different. They want to look better.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing I don't understand, for this doctor to get approval, and as Marjorie said, the piece says the earliest to be available is 2016. For who has to decide that this procedure is as risk-free as possible, or whatever the standard is?
Oh, this will be an FDA one. It's going into the body, so yeah, it'll get regulated. It's a biologic into the body of some kind.
Okay,
so there should be some standard set.
Were you about?
By the way, here's a question.
Yeah,
just to parallel this, and you can send your angry emails to Jim and Marjorie.
Yeah,
are for people who use them voluntarily in a way, are erectile dysfunction drugs a version of this?
What do you mean?
About inflating things temporarily?
Oh.
Well, I guess the answer is yeah, isn't it? But it's been proven to be risk-free unless you have, what is it, 4 years of an erection? You have to call it. Oh, it's four. No. Okay, let's move on. This is a big mistake.
I think it's 4 hours.
Whatever
it is. I don't think they're without side effects. You know, a lot of people's marriages have been ruined by their 65-year-old husband running around.
You think Liddy Dahl was upset with Bob Dole. And
that's why Liddy Dahl had to run for president, because Bob was chasing around the Watergate.
Hey, one last thing. You brought up, you were about to make a comment on Renee Zellweger, and I shut you off. I have to say, I don't know if we've ever discussed this. Arguably, I think it is probably the most dramatic facial change that most of us have ever seen from plastic surgery.
Michael Jackson.
Well, you can still recognize Michael Jackson. You can't recognize Zellweger.
Yeah.
Is there other than, I mean, it's her judgment. The theory is that this, she denies she even had it. This is what she wanted. If she's satisfied, is it your business as an ethicist, or I don't mean ours, but is there an ethical issue if this is what she was shown, this is what she wanted, and she got what she paid for? Is there an issue? There's not, is there?
No. I mean, in a sense, you go in informed consent. That's why I said ethicists like competency a lot.
Yeah.
Then you're kind of off the hook, and you say, well, you know, it's explained. You saw the photos. You knew what could happen. You knew what the range of outcomes were, and you went for it. So it's not that a plastic surgeon is beyond a malpractice claim, but you'd have to show that the outcome was the result of a mistake, not just sort of the result of the best you could do.
You know what's so weird
about that? She looks like Kim Basinger now. You know, she used to look like Renee Zellweger. Now she looks like a different person.
Well, I don't know. I saw a picture. It's just bad.
Yeah.
Bad.
Yeah, I'm with you. Hey, last thing. Marjorie and I were fighting, as we always do, about cigarette issues. I don't know if you're aware that there's this little town in Massachusetts, Westminster, Massachusetts, which if the Board of, I think it's called the Board of Health there, whatever the health entity is, if they get their way and the meeting had to be canceled midway because of the contentiousness of it, this past Wednesday night, if they get their way, cigarette sales will be the first community in America where cigarette sales are banned everywhere. I think it's a good idea because of the impact on kids. Marjorie thinks it's ridiculous. Where are you?
Well, it's still a legal product most places. Trying to ban it at the community level is going to be pretty tough just as a matter of public policy. But if you're going to ban cigarettes, you're going to have to ban a lot of other activities that are pretty nasty and dangerous too.
Like Haagen-Dazs or what?
Drinking gets up there pretty quick. Yeah. So I don't know that I'd be in it. I understand the drive to do it. I get the idea to sort of just take it away once and for all is a bad thing. Maybe it would be all right to do it if you substituted in legalization of marijuana.
But wait a second. Let's get back to for a second. Were you against Massachusetts was one of the trailblazers, I believe. It was individual communities, including my adopted hometown of Cambridge, and then it spread. Now it's statewide.
Different. This is different.
Were you against the banning of cigarette smoking in restaurants? I know it's different because of the health of the employees.
Yeah, it's much different. Not the same.
That's a secondhand smoke problem.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I'm all for that.
You know, all right, we don't have time today, but one of the times that you're with us, I'm going to share with you Jim's list of products he wants to ban. Mm-hmm. It's very extensive.
Well, it's got to be an extra long segment, obviously.
Yeah, it's going to be an extra long segment.
Okay,
enough of
that.
An extra long
Okay, Art,
list.
What's on the podcast this week, Art Kaplan?
So this week we're going to take a look at a very tough case. What do you do in an organ donation situation when one of the parents probably caused the death of the child? And that is one miserable situation. Parents often divide. They say, please donate the organs. And somebody says, but didn't you shake the baby? Isn't that the problem?
Oh my goodness.
So we get a miserable case just like that right here in New York. And we're going to try and understand that one. We get them and they're terrible. They're awful.
Wow.
We'll
okay.
be listening. Hey,
yeah.
Art Kaplan, thank you as always.
Hey, my pleasure.
Thank you, Art. Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. All right, we'd love to talk to you. Great to have you here. Talk to you next week.